three cycles of seven that are recorded for us in this book. We have seven seals, followed by seven trumpets, which are all leading up to seven bowls. And each of the ones that we've looked at so far, the seals and the trumpets, are in preparation for the seven bowls and the contents of the scroll. We've talked about how the seven seals symbolize the authority and the ownership of the message. A seal at the time would have been used to denote where a message was coming from. The seal of the king on a scroll would show that that came from the scroll. The seal of the emperor in Rome would serve the same purpose. We also looked at the fact that in the midst of those seven seals, God's people also were given a mark from God. And they were given that on their forehead. We then moved on to the seven trumpets, which we discussed served as a warning, a call to action in that time period. We noticed that between the seals and the trumpets, the focus of the warnings seemed to be different. With the seven seals, those seem to exist to affirm God's power and authority to those who believe. The seven trumpets seem to call out to those who need to repent, going so far as one of the trumpet's signs was the coming of the Messiah himself. We hit like we did in the middle of the seals, a side vision in the middle of the seven trumpets, where we looked at a scroll that John was supposed to eat. And like places that we've seen people eating God's word in the Old Testament, it tasted sweet. But there was a new wrinkle in this interpretation of it, in that it tasted sweet to John, but it made his stomach bitter. That God's word is good, but the implications this time are challenging. We talked about the vision of the two witnesses, and this is where we're going to pick up today. We talked about how the vision of the two witnesses does seem to be set in Jerusalem rather than Rome, based off some of the things that are written here. That the witnesses invoke imagery of Elijah and Moses and the things that happen around them, and that they are put to death but survive due to God's power, that nothing man can do can stop his message from spreading. One of the challenges that I've historically had with this section of Revelation, and I was talking a little bit with a couple of you afterwards, and it seemed worth bringing back to class, which is why we're picking up here, is that I've always gone into Revelation in the past with the preconception that this book is all about Rome. Spoiler alert. And therefore, everything in it has to be viewed through the lens purely of Rome, which makes the section about the witnesses in particular makes it challenging. Because really there's little in that section that seems to be relevant to Rome itself. So this time through I took a step back and asked myself, okay, what is Revelation really about? Am I coming at it from a wrong angle by just saying it's about Rome and leaving it at that? And this time in my read through, because you should really never try to do anything with the book of Revelation unless you've read it through like three times. being a holy number, of course. Seven times would be even better. That the message of Revelation, while it does concern Rome, the real message is about God removing obstacles to his message, to his people. It's about removing the systematic persecution they were facing in their time period and in the years to come, so that Christianity could flourish without so much of the death. And persecution came from two sources in the first century. One of them would certainly be Rome. Although it's really not until about the second century that things get really bad with Rome. And then the other source is where we see persecution from all the way through the book of Acts. You know, we often talk about Roman persecution, but in truth, most of the persecution recorded in the New Testament doesn't actually come from Rome. Where does it come from?
From the Jews.
Okay, from the Jewish leaders. Those same people who had a problem with Jesus continue to have a problem with his followers after they saw that they were amassing the same kind of following, that they were converting Jews first and then the Gentiles, but Jews first to this newfangled religion, they systematically persecuted Christians. I mean, that's all part of what Paul, formerly Saul, was all about, right? Zealously following Christians from town to town. So what do we see here with the witnesses? We have God proclaiming that his prophets would be put to death and that they would be laid down in the same place where the Messiah was sacrificed. But yet they would be raised again after 3.5 days. And they would continue through God's power to turn the world upside down. God is assuring his people that not only is he going to remove the persecution from the new world power from their minds, that of the Empire of Rome, but he is going to remove the old persecutions as well. Those that are based in the past. And therefore, nothing can stand in the way of God's message. The sad irony, of course, is that that persecution comes from a group of leaders who should have known better, right? And I can't imagine how God must feel to have to work against those who were formerly his people in order to get the new kingdom in a safe place. So before we move on to the woman, the child, and the dragon here in chapter 12, this is some fun stuff. Any more questions, comments, brilliant insights, and or epiphanies about the two witnesses? Emerson.
So I'm not sure this really... some sort of epiphany that helps us understand the two witnesses in Revelation. But in Zechariah 4, this is the background to Revelation 11. You have this vision that Zechariah sees of two olive trees, and they're dripping their olive oil into this lampstand. And Zechariah asks, what are the two olive trees? And the Lord says, these are the two anointed ones who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth. So I think the two witnesses in Revelation 11 would harken back to the two olive trees,
mm-hmm.
Which the Lord calls them anointed ones standing by the Lord of the whole earth, which may convey the idea that God is seeing his work through for Zechariah to lead the people to rebuild the temple. I just wanted to mention that because, you know, this Revelation 11 chapter seems so out of the blue. Where do these olive trees come from?
Right.
Well, the background is in Zechariah 4.
Yeah.
And whoever they are, we have to understand in the light of that passage in Zechariah 4.
Yeah, that's a really great point there. And thanks for bringing that back up. I know we talked about it after class on Sunday. But yeah, just as Emerson said, if you had a hard time hearing him, the imagery that we have at the beginning of the vision of the two witnesses, where he talks about them being like olive trees and like lampstands, harkens to the book of Zechariah. And there, God says he has two witnesses as well. So again, God in this vision is asking John to use imagery that is established, this prophetic language that helps us understand what's going on. It's all part of the big code of Revelation, and we're getting closer and closer to the decoder chapter. I get very excited when we get there. All right, so the seventh trumpet blows. And we see a vision of the Messiah, and again, those gathered around the throne bow down and worship and sing praises. The sanctuary of heaven is opened. The Ark of the Covenant appears there again. We have repeated imagery, now to imagery of the tabernacle being used. And now we have another vision. Before we get to the bowls. And that's where we are in Revelation chapter 12. So let's talk about the woman, the child, and the dragon here for a few minutes. I'm just going to go ahead and read this vision, and then we'll talk through it, okay? A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in labor and agony as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven. There was a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. His tail swept away a third of the stars in heaven and hurled them to the earth. And the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she did give birth, he might devour her child. But she gave birth to a son, a male who was going to shepherd all nations with an iron scepter. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God to be fed there for 1260 days. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels also fought, but he could not prevail, and there was no place for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was thrown out, the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the one who deceives the whole world. He was thrown to earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "The salvation and power and kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah have now come, because the accuser of our brothers has been thrown out, the one who accuses them before God day and night. They conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony they did not love their lives in the face of death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and those who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you with great fury, because he knows he has a short time. When the dragon saw he'd been thrown to earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. The woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, so that she could fly from the serpent's presence to her place in the wilderness, where she was fed for a time and half a time. From his mouth, the serpent spewed water like a river flowing after the woman to sweep her away in a torrent. But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the river that the dragon had spewed from his mouth. So the dragon was furious with the woman and left to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and have the testimony about Jesus. He stood on the sand of the sea. Now, this is actually going to flow straight into what we call Revelation 13. He stood on the sand of the sea leads into the beast coming out of the sea in Revelation 13. But we're going to stop right there. And we're going to talk about this woman and the dragon and the child now. So the easy part. The dragon represents Satan. And we know that because it tells us. Thank you, Revelation. There aren't too many places where Revelation turns and looks at us and says, this is what this symbol means, guys. Don't get lost here. So that's very helpful. So, since the dragon is Satan. Well, let's go then to the second easiest one. What then is represented here by the child?
My guess would be Christ, and in verse 5, it says that he is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. That comes from Psalm 2.
Yeah, it does.
That's the end of Psalm.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that that represents Christ.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up the Psalm 2 here, because there's so many cool references in this section, some of which we've seen right here in Revelation. And sort of give connection to some of the visions. But yes, the vision here calls out to Psalm chapter 2. Incidentally, Psalm chapter 2 is also where we get part of the phrase, "Behold, my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased," or "in whom my soul delights." The part about my beloved son, my elect one, comes also out of Psalm chapter 2. So I think it's a really cool connection here that in order to identify the Son, John here, or God through John, uses another phrase from that same Psalm to identify the Messiah here. There's some other cool connections. The mother, who we're going to talk about in just a second, or the woman, sorry, the woman here, is fleeing to a sanctuary in the wilderness. And where is she? How long is she there for?
Times and half a time.
Ooh. That's coming.
Yeah.
Going to the number that happens first. Verse 6. The woman fled into the wilderness. 1,260 days. Back up. Chapter 11, verse 3. How long do the two witnesses prophesy? 1,260 days. The woman is in the wilderness for 1,260 days. I don't know what the exact connection here is, but I'm pretty sure there is one. Because after the 1,260 days in chapter 11, during that time period, no one could harm them. But after the days of their prophecy, what happened to them? After that 1,260 days. You kind of have to skip all the way down to verse 7 in chapter 11 to get to it. They're killed. And by what?
By the beast.
By the beast that comes up out of the abyss.
Yeah.
After this vision of the woman, the child, and the dragon, in chapter 13, we see a beast coming out of the sea or coming out of the abyss. And I'm pretty sure the beast in chapter 13 is the same one that kills the two witnesses in chapter 11. All right, we're going to talk about that when we get there in a second, but I wanted you to see that connection. Yes. Rick noticed another connection, that she was fed in the wilderness here for a time and half a time. Where else do we see time and half a time?
Daniel.
Yes, in the book of Daniel. How is it used in Daniel? Okay, really for Daniel, that's the time between he receives the prophecy and those prophecies actually come to fruition. This woman is being protected for a similar period of time, for the same period of time, a time, times, and a half time. We have another indeterminate but complete period of time that is not all times, it's not all eternity, that would be symbolized probably by time three times, but we fall short of eternity here by having a half a time. This is something that's still happening within the confines of this temporal world. Just like the vision of Daniel was a vision that would take place in the existence of this temporary world. It's not three times, but it's two and a half. It falls just short. All right? So that gets us to the woman. What do you think the woman represents here? And does she represent only one thing?
Over a period of time, the faithful that would be the base for those accepting Jesus when he does come and recognize that he is the Messiah. And so as a result, they have maintained the lineage, you might say, of David, and bringing him up to Christ. But it's not just the kings, it's the faith of the Jews that would come. Some would recognize it as Mary. And then if you look at, Isaiah 66 verse 7 following, and he talks about the woman. And then Micah, a couple times, chapter 4, beginning verse 10, he talks about an image similar to this, and he carries it on in the fifth chapter.
All right. So there are a couple possibilities there. Again, if you had a hard time hearing it all, Dad brought up the fact that there's the possibility that this woman is representing the righteous remnant that has preserved the promise of God through the ages, and eventually, that's where the Messiah comes forth from. Or, you could have a more literal interpretation and just see this as Mary. Before I start to narrow down where I'm coming from here, any more takes on who the woman could represent, whether or not you agree with that take? The only light we have, okay?
She's the sun, the moon, and the stars, and that's the only light we have.
All right.
As the church itself.
All right. That it could also represent the church itself?
Particularly when in verse 13, where chapter 12, where again he comes back, the dragon saw, well, he persecuted the woman and he gave birth to the male child. And then she was given 2 weeks to go out. Mary no longer this particular time.
Okay.
Either that or the second woman. So as a result, the church would have still existed at that particular time.
Okay. I think that's, yeah, that makes sense. I have the most issues with the woman myself in this one in terms of, like, what is John actually trying to get across here? I'll tell you what I don't think. I don't think it's Mary, to be totally honest with you. Now, I don't know if that is me being completely fair to the text or me kind of having a knee-jerk reaction against the deification of Mary and therefore, because this is one of those passages that's kind of used as a proof text for the deification of Mary. Beification? I know, elevating her to sainthood, but not to godhood. My mistake there with the word. You know, where she is a person who intercedes for sins on our behalf, where she is a person who has a direct line to God, much like the Messiah. So I don't know if that's because of that. I tend to start it at the beginning of the chapter where Dad kind of started, and that is with this representing, this is the righteous remnant, those who are seen as pleasing in God's sight, who are struggling to survive through the captivities, through the kind of dark intertestament period, but who will ultimately bring about the Messiah through the lineage that they faithfully preserve. But then that righteous remnant evolves. The righteous remnant expands from being just a sect of Jews into being a larger group of God's people. And I think that's where we are when we get to the bottom portion, where she has continued to survive, and she's continued to be preserved by God, and the dragon continues to persecute her and her children. And again, John here inserts an interpretation of the children to us, those who keep God's commands and have the testimony about Jesus. Again, Mary isn't a forebearer of Christian people. Christian people come from the church, and the church is possible because of the righteous remnant. And the righteous remnant were the first to receive the gospel message, again, to the Jews first, and then could become the church. Dad, you've been waiting to say something.
In the church are the bride of Christ.
So yes.
So, you know, righteous people of God are, I think, basically, whether they're in the Old Testament or New Testament, those people under the Old Testament who were righteous were cleansed by the same blood that cleanses us, going back to Hebrews 9 chapter. So it's the righteous of God, whether under the Old Covenant or the New Covenant. Mm-hmm. The Old Covenant first, and then comes the New Covenant.
Right. So what do we get here then? We get this eternal struggle that John is picturing for us in God's vision here. We get this eternal struggle between God's power and his plan to save humanity's souls and the power of Satan. And time and again, what is the outcome? Or time and a half, What is the outcome of that struggle?
The good prevails, the righteous, those that keep commandments, they
survive. Right, there, you both got it. God prevails. So if you want to read this chapter as a symbolic battle that has been going on through the ages from the Old Testament into the New Testament, or you want to take verse 7 through 12 as a literal battle that broke out between God's angels and the demons of Satan, either way you look at it, the result is the same. This is a message, like that of the two witnesses, that God's power overcomes anything that resists it. In the vision of the two witnesses, it is man's power that is resisting God's people. They are put to death in the city by the powers given to them in the world. Getting a little ahead to the beast of chapter 13 that gets brought up in chapter 11. Man's power could not defeat the witnesses. They overcame through God's power, were resurrected, and continued on their mission. Now we get the same story a second time in a row. Only now, instead of it being man who's resisting God's plan, we see this divine power, the spiritual power of Satan, seeking to resist God. Another non-mortal being and his spiritual forces waging war against the power and the majesty of God and his angels. And he cannot overcome. However, we do see, and we'll see this again, that Satan does get a little bit of ground here. Not victorious ground, but ground on which he can still work. And then we get that at the end of verse 12. Rejoice, you heavens, and who dwell to them. Woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you with a great fury, because he knows he has a short time. Satan knows he has lost. He knows his time is limited. And he's going to use that limited time to do as much damage as he can. I almost picture him as, have you ever gotten, and I have a painful memory of this, have you ever gotten like a wasp stuck in your shirt or something like that? At this point, the wasp knows it's done for. As far as the wasp is concerned, there is no hope that it is going to get out of this situation of being trapped in this spot. But wasps are vindictive little bugs, and that wasp is going to make sure it does as much damage as it can to whatever it views as its captor before it goes down. I see Satan here as that stinging wasp who's trapped, who knows he can't win, who knows he can't get out of this, but he's a vindictive little guy, and he is going to do as much damage as he can in the time he has left. So what does he do in verses 13 through 18? He continues to persecute. He continues to rail against the inevitable. And that leads us into chapter 13. Where the dragon here is standing on the sands of the sea, and now we see two beasts in chapter 13. We have a beast from the sea and a beast from the earth. Incidentally, back up again to verse 12 in chapter 12. Woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you. I don't know about anyone else who might know this old song, but I read the verse, the devil came down, and my brain wants to fill it in with, to Georgia. So before we move on to these two beasts, any more thoughts on the vision of the dragon, the woman, and the child? Okay.
Just introductory looking at this is devil's been two allies.
Yes.
Well, I think he's had allies similar to that back in the time of what Ahab and a lot of the different kings of Israel. But he's got just these allies now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think this is repetitive to him.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Again, the messages in Revelation are cyclical. And sometimes we hit a theme and we go through it multiple times from multiple perspectives. And Dad's right here. I think what we're seeing a description here are allies of the dragon, of Satan. Because we end chapter 12 with the dragon standing on the sands of the sea, facing out toward the sea. So if you have a beast coming out of the sea, while the dragon is out facing it, that beast cannot also be the dragon. Right? If I'm standing in front of a door and I'm watching someone come out of the door, I'm not in both places. Therefore, I don't think that the beasts that we're going to be talking about here in Revelation 13 are representative of Satan himself, like the dragon is. I think we're looking at a couple more things of power. So let's start with the beast from the sea. And since my throat's getting really dry, I'll cede the reading responsibilities. Who wants to take verses 1 through 10 here? Go ahead, Mike.
And he stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him? And there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemy. And authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe, and people, and tongue, and nation was given to him. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world. In the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints.
All right, thank you so much. So we have this great beast coming up. And I don't know about you, but I instantly picture another great beast as soon as this one starts getting described from the Old Testament. Does anyone get any, feel like this is referencing anything that we've read in a previous book? Dad? Okay.
I've got it right here.
Fantastic.
And he said, after this, I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had its back four wings of a bird, and beast also had four heads, dominion, given to it, and this I kept looking in the night vision, and behold, the fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder of its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, for it had 10 horns.
All right. Now we're going to break this down just a little bit, and we're going to pick this back up next Sunday, because there's no way we're going to make it through the beasts in the time we have left, and that is okay. So when we're looking at prophetic language, when something has horns, what is that usually emblematic of? Okay, there's the devil.
I think of a bull, how destructive they can be when they are charging at a person. They do damage.
Okay.
They're not necessarily going to be deadly.
All right, so something that is destructive.
Power and authority.
Okay, and those two things right there speak to power and authority. And then that authority is reinforced here, that he's wearing, this beast is wearing 10 crowns. So we have 10 horns. This is, and 10 diadems. Whatever this beast is, to the Christians who are reading this, this is something that has, to their minds at least, all power and authority. Go ahead, Dad.
Different.
They are. You're right.
Which have been previously talked about.
Yes.
These are actually something during the time of the Persians.
Okay.
They wore a special band on their heads to show that they had authority. And that's the origination of this type of a crown. In contrast to the victorious crowns of an athlete or something.
Uh-huh.
Signify government.
Okay. Right. This would be different than a crown that would be used to symbolize any other type of victory or greatness. These symbolize true worldly power. And we have all of these creatures that have all kinds of power behind them being pictured here. We have a leopard, a bear, a lion. Right? None of these are things that invoke images of comfort. Right? And it says here that the dragon gave him great authority. And that they worship the dragon because of the authority they give to this beast. And he speaks blasphemy. He has authority for 42 months. I find 42 interesting for two reasons. One has nothing to do with Revelation, and that is number 42 is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything in Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The meaning of life is 42. The thing that's interesting to Revelation, and not just my own silliness, is how do you get 42?
6 by 7.
All right. What do you get when you multiply 6 by 7? 42. 7 is something that's complete, but 6 is... Okay, it is short of that. So it's given authority, but it doesn't have authority for all time. And again, I think it's also interesting that it's not for like 42 years here, or 42 eons, or 42 times, but it's just 42 what? Months. I think we're seeing something here that in the overall perspective of history, while it seems overwhelming when it's here, is ultimately going to be a flash in the pan. It has a shorter time period than almost anything we've talked about in Revelation so far. It's just here for months. And it's permitted to wage war against the saints, etc., etc. Okay, so here we have this beast who is pictured as having worldly power, is given images of government on its head, who seemed all-powerful in the lives of the people who are reading it, because remember, we always want to watch this through first-century eyes, who seems to have all authority, but ultimately isn't going to last forever. What would that be to a first-century Christian? Yeah, I think you were mouthing it too, Katie. Yes. I think we have here the first real indication in this book that some of these prophecies point directly to the worldly authority under which they lived at that time. And that would be the Roman Empire. Go ahead, Emerson.
So in Daniel 7, there are four beasts.
There are, yes.
And each of those specifically represents an empire.
Uh-huh.
And the fourth represents, this is one of those places where God actually explains what it is. It says, the fourth beast will be like a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. And so it goes on to talk about how they will, the beast will wear down the saints, and they will persecute the saints. And so I think it's an empire that is persecuting God's people.
Right, and then he uses the same imagery right here. Excellent. I'm going to give you one more thing to think about. Number one, there's another beast coming. So we have to keep that in context. But number two, this is really interesting here. It says, one of his heads appeared to be fatally wounded, but his fatal wound was healed. Rome was not always an empire. Prior to Rome was the Republic. The line of emperors claims descendancy from one man. And do you know who that is? Okay, Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was the great military general who was tasked with protecting Rome's northern borders, who amassed such a following that he took that following and marched on the capital of Rome to the Senate in the days of the Republic before there was a Roman Empire. His own friends feared that he wished to become an emperor, so they murdered him with the intent of stopping the empire before it happened. But instead what happened is that Rome fractured between its generals. They waged war among each other. A guy by the name of Augustus came out victorious and then instituted the Roman Empire that was meant to be prevented by injuring and killing who would have probably been the first emperor had he not been killed. One head was wounded, but it didn't take down the beast. All right, let's get ready to worship. Thanks for all your comments.